From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with actor Jack Black. He nearly stole the show as the sarcastic record store clerk in High Fidelity, but he almost didn't take the part. He'll tell us why. He's also the lead singer of the mock rock cult band Tenacious D. Now he preaches the gospel of rock music to kids in the new film The School of Rock. Also, we remember director Elia Kazan, who died yesterday at the age of 94. Considered one of the leading directors in the history of theater and film, he founded the Actors Studio, directed the Broadway productions of A Streetcar Named Desire and Death of a Salesman, and the films On the Waterfront and East of Eden. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The head of the Federal Communications Commission, Michael Powell, said today that his agency will enforce the Do Not Call list set up by the Federal Trade Commission to block sales calls from telemarketers.
The minute that we believe that a telemarketer has been given the notice required that they cannot call somebody, then they're going to trigger our rules, and we will forcefully enforce them.
Two federal courts have issued rulings blocking the Federal Trade Commission from enforcing the lists, but no such actions have been taken against the FCC. President Bush signed legislation today that confirms the FTC's authority to operate the list, but doesn't deal with all the litigation that's now underway. In Northern Virginia, a Muslim activist has been arrested and charged with violating U.S. economic sanctions against Libya. Federal officials say the man's been under surveillance for more than a year as part of a probe into alleged financing of terror groups. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
According to court documents, Abdulrahman Al-Amoudi is charged with receiving some $10,000 from the Libyan government and with failing to disclose a series of trips to Libya. The affidavit also says customs officials in London last month found Al-Amoudi had $340,000 in sequentially numbered $100 bills. However, he is not charged for that. Al-Amoudi told the British agency he was president of the American Muslim Foundation and had difficulty raising money for the group, so he allegedly said he approached the Libyan government. The charges against Al-Amoudi are the first from a sweeping raid on numerous Muslim groups in Northern Virginia in March 2002. Federal agents say more charges may follow. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
The Securities and Exchange Commission has announced a subpoena action against Kenneth Lay, the former chairman and CEO of Enron. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
According to the SEC, Ken Lay has refused to produce documents that the commission subpoenaed as part of its Enron investigation. Lay is arguing that it's his Fifth Amendment right to withhold the documents. The SEC says it's looking into whether Lay had knowledge of or was involved in fraudulent activities at Enron. The commission maintains that the documents Lay is holding appear to be corporate documents and therefore are not protected by the Fifth Amendment. The commission is asking a federal court to order Lay to show why he should not comply with the subpoena and, if appropriate, order Lay to produce the withheld documents. Ken Lay and other Enron executives already invoked the Fifth Amendment, refusing to answer questions at congressional hearings last year. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
In stocks, the Dow gained 67 points to close at 9380 in active trading. The Nasdaq was up 32 at 1824. This is NPR News. A Colombian rebel group acknowledged today that it's holding seven foreign tourists who were kidnapped earlier this month. The group, known as the ELN, seized eight backpackers from an archaeological site in the mountains of northern Colombia earlier this month. One of the captives, a 19-year-old British man, managed to escape and is now safe. The remaining captives include four Israelis, a Briton, a German, and a Spaniard. The ELN statement didn't demand a ransom, but said the group is open to negotiations. The U.S. Energy Department says gasoline prices are dropping across the country. Bill Cohen reports from Ohio Public Radio.
For the fourth straight week, fuel prices are down in a big way. This past week, the average price for a gallon of regular has dropped by more than 5 cents. Since the beginning of September, the price has decreased by about 15 cents. The price cuts, though, come right after the average price hit an all-time record high. not adjusted for inflation. That means the current price, about $1.59 a gallon, is still relatively high. In fact, compared to a year ago, motorists are paying nearly 18 cents more. This month's worth of price drops may not last much longer. OPEC nations have lowered their crude oil output by more than 3%, and that's expected to shore up oil and gasoline prices. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Jury selection began today in the trials of two former top executives of Tyco International, Dennis Kozlowski, Tyco's former chief executive, and Mark Schwartz, the conglomerate's former chief financial officer, say they're not guilty of stealing about $600 million from the company. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from E-Trade Financial, dedicated to improving the way people invest, bank, and borrow, on the web at etrade.com or 1-800-ETRADE-1.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Actor Jack Black doesn't just play guys who preach the gospel of rock and roll in movies. He's spent a good part of his life worshiping at the altar himself. Black is the star of the new film School of Rock, about a would-be rock god who takes on the job of substitute teacher in a Tony prep school under false pretenses and ends up forming his class of fifth graders into a band. It's a role tailor-made for Black, who has a cult following as one half of the mock metal rock band Tenacious D, and is best known for his scene-stealing performance as a rock snob record store clerk in the film High Fidelity. His other movies include Shallow Hal, Orange County, and Saving Silverman. In Sunday's New York Times Magazine, Josh Rottenberg wrote, "With a special talent for mad flashing stares, blistering riffs of profanity, and scatological schlubbiness, Black has for years been the go-to guy for anyone casting the role of an unhinged coworker or a bong-toting roommate." Here's a scene from School of Rock. Black is revealing to his class their new revised schedule.
8:15 to 10, rock history. 10 to 11, rock appreciation and theory. And then band practice till the end of the day.
What about math?
No, not important.
Well, a lot of the film is you being intense about how great rock and roll is. And I loved so many of those lines, especially things like, "Now we lift a goblet to rock."
The goblet to rock, yes.
And I wondered if you, did you ad-lib that stuff? I would think you'd have it all down from your years preaching the gospel of rock in your band, Tenacious D.
Yeah, well, it is my specialty. And there was some ad-libbing when it came to the jamming scenes where I'm actually, like, you know, working with the kids on certain moves and stuff. Richard Linklater, the director, likes to do a lot of rehearsals and improvisation, and a lot of stuff came out of that. But for the most part, you know, when stuff seems like improv, it's just because Mike knows my voice and writes really well for me, and it seems like it. But the Goblet of Rock was mine. I'll take that.
Now, in the film, you see these kids. They're 10 years old, this class. You're substitute teaching. You see these kids in their music class playing orchestral instruments, and they're really talented, and you decide for your own reasons to redirect their talent to rock. Now, were the actors themselves, the children, classically trained musicians?
Yes, especially the kid who plays Lawrence. His name's Robert Tsai. He actually had played some big concerts in front of a lot of people. He's 10 years old. That was important to Linklater, that he get these great musician kids, because there's nothing worse than going to a movie where people are playing instruments and then they're not really playing them and you can tell.
Right, the equivalent of lip syncing on their instrument.
I mean, exactly. Having said that, I don't actually play all of my guitar solos. I can't believe I've worked my way into my own trap. But
I was just going to ask you. So why not?
No, I'm not that good on guitar. I'm the least talented of the entire cast on their instruments. I play power chords in my band. And also, I've never played electric guitar. I'm always acoustic power chord guy, and I leave all the solos up to Kyle. So then, you know, there's these face melting solos that I'm supposed to play, And if you watch the film closely, you'll see I disguise my hands really, really well. Uh-huh. I'm constantly moving and swirling. And if, you know, we're going to perform the song on some talk shows, and I'm a little concerned because when it gets to my guitar solo in the song, mm-hmm. my plan is to do a ventrilo solo. And something I invented where basically I do the solo, I sing the solo, but I don't move my lips and I keep my fingers moving. I'll give you a taste of it. Now, I need to, my throat's a little hoarse right now.
And hard on the radio, to pull this off.
Well, you can't see the incredibleness of my non-moving lips.
Exactly. How much air guitar did you play in school, in front of a mirror?
Plenty. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember when I first heard Eruption, the Eddie Van Halen guitar solo on Van Halen 1. Huh. I remember feeling like it almost made me cry. I thought it was so beautiful and hard rocking at the same time. And I felt at the time, no one, including Eddie Van Halen, appreciates this song as much as I do. And later on, I found out that everyone kind of feels that way about certain music.
Maybe not that Eddie Van Halen.
Maybe not.
Solo.
Maybe I really... Oh, come on. No, don't underestimate Eruption. That has touched many lives. And I love, you know, I have an appreciation for all kinds of music, but, you know, the metal, the heavy metal is definitely my roots.
Was that one of the first albums you got?
No. The first album I bought, the first heavy metal album I bought was Ozzy Osbourne, Blizzard of Oz.
Okay. And did that change your life?
It did indeed, because before that it was all Styx and Journey and... I don't even know what category of rock that is. It's not really prog rock. It's not progressive so much as, what is that? What do you call Styx or Journey?
Bad.
No!
Overblown? Overblown? We're getting suggestions from the crowd
it's
here?
It's very... No,
bombastic?
Those aren't subcategories of rock. I call it like... they just had great... drama. What was that song? Welcome to the Grand Illusion. Come on in and see what's happening. But there was no evil, and that's what metal brought into my life, was the love of evil rock.
When you were in your teens, it sounds like 13, 14, 15, you were having a kind of rough time of it, and you ended up in a small school for problem teenagers. I don't know if it was a reform school or what. How did you get sent there?
It was a good school. I didn't get sent there. My parents took me out of the school I was in. I was at Culver Junior High, and it wasn't the school's problem, really, but I'd gotten into doing some drugs, and I stole some money from my mom, and it was just bad time. And
what's this, like eighth grade or
ninth grade?
Yeah, that's young. Mm.
Yeah, it was too young. And then I went to Poseidon School. They only had about 20 kids in the whole school, and there was a psychologist on campus who was also like a bodybuilder. He was really big and muscly, so that if you tried to hit him or something, he would wrestle you down and then give you therapy. But anyway, you didn't have to go to the psychologist, you know. It was voluntary, but I saw other kids going there and talking to him, and I was curious about it, and I said, hey, I want to come in and talk to you. And he said, sure. And I came in, and I told him, I just started to spill my guts about what, you know, the things I was feeling guilty about. And I just started bawling. I was bawling so hard. It felt so good, though, at the same time. And, that kind of turned things around a little bit. It was kind of like many years of confession built up and then released at one time, all these secrets I was holding.
Now, tell me, how did you do in school?
I was not a very good student, to tell you the truth. I didn't have good study habits. I was a little distracted, and I would always fall asleep in class. And as soon as class was over, I would be filled with energy and go running out of the classroom. So I know it wasn't that I was tired, just that it had a... What do you call that? It doesn't matter. All I'm saying is it put me to sleep. Until I had a really good teacher in ninth grade, an acting teacher. But to tell you the truth, that didn't seem like it counts, because it really didn't feel like school at all. It felt like something so fun, and I knew I wanted to do it.
You had some parts as a kid, right?
I did.
What was your first role? Was it in a commercial?
Yeah. Well, my first role, I was the wizard in The Wizard of Oz in the Idlewild summer camp. And that was not a good part, even though it is the title role of the piece. You don't really see the wizard until the very end when
right.
he's uncovered behind the curtain. But that gave me a little taste. And I wanted to do it. I loved the attention and the magic of theater. And I talked my stepfather into taking me out to auditions when I was 13. I had this idea that if my friends saw me on television, that I would automatically become more popular. And then I got that commercial, and it worked. I was more popular.
But then it only
lasted a few days.
So were you a popular, not so popular kid? And
you know, it wasn't that I was unpopular, but I think I definitely needed a little more attention than most kids. I wanted there was something weird. There was a weird emptiness in me that needed to be filled.
Jack Black stars in the new film School of Rock. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with actor Jack Black. His films include Bob Roberts, Shallow Hal, Orange County, and High Fidelity. His new film is School of Rock. I want to talk about High Fidelity. You played Barry, and he is just a hilarious, belligerent, kind of know-it-all music fanatic record clerk. Now, you almost didn't take this part of Barry in High Fidelity, and
yeah.
I can't really imagine the film without you. What happened there?
Well, I thought it was too mean. I almost don't take every part I've ever taken. I get scared and a fear of failure. But, yeah.
Why would you worry about the part being too mean?
I don't know. A lot of actors approach, you know, what they're going to do next in terms of how much of a stretch is the role for them. Like, this part, yeah, oh, this is exciting for me because it's going to be a totally, you know, different person from me. I don't approach, I look for parts that are closer to me, that explore, you know, sides of me that I understand already. You know what I mean? So even though in retrospect this part was almost made for me, it seemed too mean at the time. It didn't seem like it wasn't a perfect fit, so I thought it was totally wrong.
Well, let's play this clip from High Fidelity. This is the scene, Jack, in which Barry refuses to sell "I Just Called to Say I Love You" to this middle-aged guy who wants to buy it for his daughter. And then Barry gets in an argument with the owner of the record store, Rob, played by John Cusack. Do you want to say anything about this scene before we play it?
Well, I'd just like to say this is one of the hardest scenes because I don't feel that judgmental. I feel like I'm a pretty forgiving, and and also I would never give someone a guilt trip over buying Stevie Wonder, even if it is his cheesiest song. He's earned a pass because of all the unbelievably great songs he's written, like the one that plays at the end credits. But anyway, here's the scene.
I'm looking for a record for my daughter for her birthday. I just called to say I love you. Do you have it?
Yeah.
Great.
We have it.
Great. Can I have it then?
No, you can't.
Why not?
Well, it's sentimental, tacky crap. That's why not. Do we look like the kind of store that sells I just called to say I love you? Go to the mall.
What's your problem?
Do you even know your daughter? There's no way she likes that song. Is she in a coma?
Oh, okay, buddy. I didn't know it was pick on the middle-aged square guy day. My apologies. I'll be on my way.
Bye-bye.
A scene from the film High Fidelity. My guest is Jack Black. So did you ever have a run-in with a clerk like this in a record store?
I'm constantly embarrassed by my... Especially now, after making that movie, with the things that I buy, I feel extra self-conscious because they're like, oh, here comes the famous record clerk from that movie. So, I don't even know if I want to say the things that I'm embarrassed of buying now.
Oh, tell us, yes.
I don't know that I'm ready to give you my...
Keep it coming.
My secret deep nuggets. Oh, no.
Oh, come on, how bad can it be?
Well, you know, it's no secret that I love the early Bobby McFerrin. I don't know that that's embarrassing. I mean, it's just because of Don't Worry, Be Happy that it's embarrassing.
An you know, icon that's when... of rock has fallen.
No! No!
Save me.
He was a big influence on me, man. What can I say? And I think, I've bought some Bobby McFerrin in record stores and felt kind of ashamed.
Now, it's hard to talk about a lot of your acting, including what you do in High Fidelity, on the radio, because it's so visual, and you use your body so emphatically. Was that something you've developed over a long period of time?
I just always feel like I have to go all the way. If I don't go all the way, I feel like I've blown it, and that translates into really high energy, kind of crazy physical performances.
Well, you play a lot of these guys who are so comfortable in their body and are so emphatic, so at ease with taking their clothes off, even if they're schlubby or, you know, not perfect physique.
Right.
Now,
what are you talking about? What are you saying?
So,
that,
are you comfortable in your body that way when you're walking around? And if not, how does it change when a camera goes on?
Right. No, I'm not that comfortable. I'm all right with my body. I think it's kind of weird looking. But I know that when I get a little bit embarrassed, I know that I'm onto something entertaining. So my need for pleasing the crowd overtakes my fear of being exposed. You know what I mean? It's a stronger urge. So, if I feel like, wait a second, if I do walk out there in my tidy whities, oh, they're going to love that. I will look like a total fool and an idiot, but, oh, I can't, I can't resist.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't stop yourself.
But it also, you know, when I'm out there, you know, dancing around and looking so free and comfortable with my body, I feel like it's also kind of masking this other thing that I'm hiding, where, you know, I don't want to show my real, like, inner demons or something, or I'm afraid that people, I'm hiding this thing that I'm, my main fear is that people are going to be bored of me, you know, the real me. So I end up, like, shooting off all my brain fireworks to mask that, I think.
This goes back to when you were saying, we were talking about the roles that you play, and that you said that, you know, some actors look for roles that stretch them, and you like to explore sides of you that you know well already.
Yeah.
Why? Why do you prefer
I want
those?
To get to the center of me. because, like I said, I am a crowd pleaser by nature. And I just want to go with my bread and butter. When it gets down to business, it's like, you know what? Do you want to see Einstein, his sketches? No. You want him to break codes. Do you want to see Picasso dance? I don't. I want him to paint me an awesome painting. Do you want to see me in a period piece about an English guy that cries a lot?
Yes, yes. I'd go to that.
It's just not my bread and butter. And maybe, you know, once I finally get to the center of me, then I'll go out and venture forth. That's the plan.
Jack Black stars in the new film School of Rock. He'll rock some more in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
I've been really trying, baby, trying to hold on to this feeling for so long. And if you feel like I feel, sugar, come on.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader. Available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. By Warner Home Video, featuring Yankee Doodle Dandy, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and The Adventures of Robin Hood as part of the Warner Legends collection on DVD. From Scholastic Press, publisher of Old Turtle and the Broken Truth, a tale of peace and tolerance by Douglas Wood and illustrator John J. Muth, a first book selection. And by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the new album Stumble Into Grace by Emmylou Harris, available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember the man who directed the films On the Waterfront and East of Eden. We listen back to a 1988 interview with Elia Kazan. He died yesterday at the age of 94. And more of our interview with actor Jack Black. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with actor and singer Jack Black. He stars in the new film School of Rock. His other film roles include High Fidelity, Orange County, and Shallow Hal. He's also one half of the mock rock duo Tenacious D. I want to talk about Tenacious D. How did you and Kyle Gass start the band? Were you just jamming together?
Yeah, you know, we were both in this theater company, the Actors Gang.
The Tim Robbins troupe.
Yeah, Robbins troupe. And he was kind of the designated musical guy in the company, and I came into the company later, and I wanted to be the musical guy. So there was kind of a rivalry right from the get-go. There was some animosity between the two of us for, you know, he wanted to keep his turf, and I definitely wanted in on some of that action. But then eventually we joined forces and became best friends and would go over to his little apartment on Cochrane Avenue in Hollywood. We called it the Cockroach. And we would just spend hours jamming in with a tape recorder recording everything. And we would do that, and then we would have what we called stony playback, where we would listen back and see if there were any nuggets in there. But yeah, we had a lot of good times just jamming just for kicks. And then eventually, after years of that, we wrote our first song that we performed in front of an audience. We wrote Tribute, which we wanted to write the greatest song in the world.
And you did.
We did not. Well, we wrote it, but we couldn't remember it. We weren't taping. That was the one time we weren't taping. So then we were like, we have to write a tribute to the song that's lost. And that's what we did.
This is the greatest and best song in the world.
Tribute.
Long time ago, me and my brother Kyle here, we was hitchhiking down a long and lonesome road. All of a sudden, there shined a shiny demon in the middle of the road. And he said, play the best song in the world, or I'll eat your soul. Well, me and Kyle, we looked at each other, and we each said, okay. And we played the first thing that came to our heads, just so happened to be the best song in the world. It was the best song in the world. Look into my eyes and it's easy to see, one and one make two, two and one make three. It was destiny. Once every 100,000 years or so, when the sun doth shine and the moon doth glow and the dust doth grow.
You've written a screenplay featuring Tenacious D. What's the story? What status is that?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, we've done it. We've cracked the code. And the Tenacious D screenplay is finished. And I'm very proud of it. But, you know, we're trying to get a deal with New Line Pictures. And if we get that deal done, then we'll turn it into them and see if they have a lot of notes.
And what happens with Tenacious D in the film?
Well, it starts, I'm going to tell you what I can. We start before there was a Tenacious D.
In the Dark Ages.
Yeah. Yes. It's you're going to see me as a 10-year-old. And we haven't asked him yet, but hopefully we'll get Meatloaf to play my father. And
oh, that's great. You remind me so much of Meatloaf.
Yeah, we share a lot of things. I've definitely bitten off some of his moves. Huh. But anyway, I run away from home because he doesn't understand the metal, the heavy metal that I need to, you know. And I find Kyle in Los Angeles, and he becomes my guru and my teacher. And we form Tenacious D, and then we go on our first epic quest. And that's the movie. That's all I'm comfortable telling you.
It sounds like the Ring cycle.
Yeah. You find out the real reason why we are named Tenacious D. You find out all the things that you need in an origin type of, you know, movie. We're giving the true story behind a legendary band.
Well, I really enjoyed meeting you and talking with you today on Fresh Air. Thank you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Jack Black stars in the new movie, School of Rock. Rock. Coming up, we remember Ilya Kazan. This is Fresh Air. Ilya Kazan, one of the foremost directors of Hollywood films and Broadway theater, died yesterday in Manhattan at the age of 94. Many critics consider Kazan to be the most influential director of American actors in the 20th century. He discovered and cast Marlon Brando, James Dean, and Warren Beatty in such films as Streetcar Named Desire, On the Waterfront, East of Eden, and Splendor in the Grass. His films also include Baby Doll, A Face in the Crowd, and The Last Tycoon. Kazan's career in theater was equally influential. In the 1930s, he worked with the group theater, where he followed the vision of Lee Strasberg and learned the style of acting that became known as the method. He later co-founded the Actors Studio with Strasberg. Many of Kazan's friends and colleagues never forgave him for naming names when he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee during its relentless search for communists and communist sympathizers. In later years, Kazan published several novels, also his autobiography, in which he defended his actions during the Red Scare. Terry spoke with Ilya Kazan in 1988, after the publication of his memoir, A Life. Before we hear their conversation, let's revisit a signature Brando moment.
I shot her!
You put that howling down there and go to bed.
Yes, I want my girls out here.
You shut up! You're going to get the law on you.
I still am!
And then call her back because she ain't going to come. You're going to have a baby.
Listen, you're
I'll say haul you in and turn a file.
Who's the girl down here?
You stink.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
I wouldn't mix in this.
Ilya Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to talk with you specifically about some of the movies you've directed and some of the scenes within those films. Let's start with A Streetcar Named Desire. Now, you actually really discovered Marlon Brando for the stage version of that, which you directed before directing the film. Why did you want him to audition for the role in the stage version?
Well, there was no audition. I had produced a play with Harold Klerman where he played a part, and he played it like a 5-6 minute scene, and he was stupendous and he was marvelous in it. And that was his audition. He didn't know it. But then when we lost John Garfield and I began to think who really would be good as Stanley Kowalski, I thought of Marlon and gave him $20 to go up and see Tennessee Williams up at the Cape. I learned later he hadn't showed up, but he'd hitchhiked and used the $20 to eat with. So, but anyway, Williams took to him immediately. He called me up. He was ecstatic. He was overwhelmed, and that's all the audition there was.
when I think of all the actors and all the people in general who have imitated Brando doing Stella, what went on when you were directing him in that scene?
In that scene?
Yeah.
I just told him to get on his knees at the bottom of the staircase, but I didn't tell him what to do with his voice or how he should shout it. He just knew. Once in a decade, a voice like that comes out.
Now, you directed Brando again 3 years later in On the Waterfront. I found out in your book that it was initially supposed to be Frank Sinatra in the role.
Yeah, he would have been damn good, too, but not as good as Brando. I don't think anybody's as good as Brando, but Frank would have been very good. Frank comes from Hoboken, and he's a street kid, too, and he's tough, and he would have been good, and he's tough the way Brando's tough. He's got a tough exterior and knows what to do with his fists and so on, but he also has a very poetic and romantic side that comes out in his songs, of course. Anyway, I was ready to do it with Frank, but one thing led to another in the contracting, and also in Frank's schedule. He had to be somewhere at a certain time. I've forgotten the details of it, and we switched to Brando.
Brando in that movie really has this combination of strength and vulnerability.
Right, Terry, you hit it.
What did you talk with him about when he took on the role? About what characteristics you wanted him to get in there?
Just that. I said he keeps a tough front towards everybody, but he feels his guilt about Eva Marie Saint's brother terribly, that it kills him. He can't get rid of it. And he really would like to be out of the gangster hoodlum world and didn't like what they did to him because they humiliate him. The part Lee Cobb played constantly humiliated him, made him appear like a cheap kid, and I told him that he would resent that and not show it for a while, and then release it as the film went on.
I want to play another one of the most famous scenes in movie history. And this is the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. Now, in your book, you're very self-effacing about it. You say that you've been highly praised for the direction of the scene, but the truth is you didn't really direct it. It kind of directed itself. I don't truly believe that, so let's hear the scene, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll say one thing about it before you do.
Okay.
The scene is good for several reasons, but one reason is because it was beautifully written by Bud Schulberg. It's a perfectly written scene, and in a kind of a tough language that is poetic in itself, that's all.
And the scene is played by Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger.
Right.
That skunk we got you for the manager, he brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. You remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
There's a musicality in the way those two actors read their lines that is really something. Did you work with them on that?
No. I didn't direct that scene much. I didn't direct that scene, really. By that time in the shooting schedule, both Rod and Marlon knew what they had. And then the lines themselves are so beautifully written. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, that's the way those people talk. They're perfectly written lines, and Marlon naturally took to them.
You know, it's great. It's your classic talking head scene. It's two guys in a cab. In the rear view window, there's actually Venetian blinds, so you can't even see the traffic coming through.
There isn't any.
Yeah, so no. it's just two guys talking.
If we had traffic, Terry, it would have been a distraction, wouldn't it? Don't you think so?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because you're just totally focused on their faces and on what they're saying.
Right.
A lot of the extras in On the Waterfront were actually longshoremen.
Right, and hoodlums.
And hoodlums, yeah. So you had a bodyguard in the making of the movie?
I had a bodyguard 6 feet behind me at all times. Well, there were some rough characters all around me, and they were taking offense that we showed Hoboken, for example, for a bad place, and they were offended. I laugh at that. But anyway, they had civic pride. That's what made me laugh. I thought they had civic pride, and nobody threatened me much. A fella came and slammed me against the wall and was going to beat me up, but then the bodyguard and another friend named Brownie came up, and that was the end of that threat.
Let's move on to another movie you directed. Now, we talked about how you really basically discovered Marlon Brando. You also really discovered James Dean. You gave him his first film role in your film East of Eden.
Yeah.
I find that kind of interesting in a way because they were both at the time young actors with this pent-up energy and alienation.
Yeah, that's it. Alienation is right. Pent-up energy is right. Terry, you've got it exactly right. Not especially. Both of them, the same way. Same thing in both of them. Somehow that must have appealed to me because maybe I have pent-up energy and alienation, too. I feel brotherly towards them.
I want to play a scene from this movie, and this is a scene where, well, let me, for our listeners who haven't seen the movie in a long time, in East of Eden, there's a father played by Raymond Massey, and he has two sons. One son he favors, the son he doesn't favor is James Dean. And James Dean has worked really hard to endear himself to his father. He's invested money in bean futures in the hopes of making back money that his father lost. And it's his father's birthday. He's presenting him the money, but his father won't accept it. Here's that scene with Raymond Massey and James Dean.
That's for you. And it's all the money you lost in the lettuce business. That's for you, and I made it for you.
Cal, you will have to give it back.
No, I made it for you, Dad. I want you to have it.
You'll have to give it back.
Who? I can't give it.
To the people you got it from.
No, British Purchasing Agency? I can't give it back to them.
Then give it to the farmers you robbed.
We didn't rob anybody. That we paid 2 cents a pound, 2 cents over the market for that stuff.
Cal, I sign my name, and boys go out, and some die, and some live helpless without arms and legs. Not one will come back untorn. Do you think I could take a profit from that? I don't want the money, Cal. I couldn't take it. I thank you for the thought, but
I'll keep it for you. I'll wrap it up, and we'll just keep it in here.
I'll never take it.
There's a great part right after that where you can't tell whether James Dean is going to hug or slug his father.
That is good, yeah.
Now, you write in your book that there really was a tension between James Dean and Raymond Massey. And
yes,
you basically tried to exploit that in the movie.
They didn't like each other. And especially Ray Massey couldn't stand Dean. He just hated to play scenes with him. And I guess I did exploit it because I didn't do anything about curing it or easing it. And you see how much he resents him in the scene, in the role, but also he did in life. And it served my purposes to not do anything about it. I didn't egg them on to each other, but I didn't do anything to keel it.
If James Dean had more technique as an actor, if he had been more experienced, would it have been unnecessary to play up that antagonism in real life between Dean and Massey?
It wouldn't have hurt, Terry. The truth is it wouldn't have hurt. Everybody's so chummy on a stage set, you know. Everybody gets coffee and gets flattered and everything else, and very soon they lose the sense of what they... a very driving emotion underneath the scene. They become comfortable. Comfortable is not good when an actor gets too and stays away from everybody and stays, you know, just is flattered and has his girlfriend there too. God knows what goes on. You know, it's better to irritate them a little bit so they're on edge. I mean, it's very serious business, a emotional film.
Yeah. You know, in the clips that we just heard, we heard from Brando and from Dean, two very different actors in that Brando you describe as an actor with a lot of technique, Dean as an actor who had virtually none, at least at the time you directed him. How does that change you as a director, depending on whether you're working with someone who has a lot of technique or someone who's more of a natural and doesn't have that technique?
You adapt to what each one is. I talked more to Jimmy than I ever did to Marlon. I took him aside and... finally, when I felt he was disturbed in life by what was happening in his own personal life, I moved him into a dressing room on the Warner Brother lot, and I took the dressing room directly facing it so that I'd always be at hand. I was like a father to him, or a big brother to him, and looked after him. Every morning I'd call him out and see what condition he was in, whether he had a miserable night or not. And then I had to several times stop him from owning a horse or a motorbike or whatever, you know. So it became a very different, more intense, more particular relationship. With Marlon, I didn't have to do anything like that.
Ilya Kazan speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. He died yesterday at the age of 94. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're remembering Ilya Kazan with an interview Terry recorded with him in 1988.
Let's talk more about acting and your style of directing. Now, you were a member of the group Theater in the mid-30s and a co-founder of the Actor Studio. These are the two places where what's been called the Method was born. How would you describe the Method, and do you think of yourself as subscribing to it?
The method has to do with retreat from artificial emotionalism, where emotion is conveyed by signs and gestures and voice patterns and so forth, but where it's where on the other hand it's actually felt by the actor. He actually feels it, the emotion that he's portraying. It's there in him, and there are techniques which are obvious. They're not so complicated and not so mysterious for arousing emotion by remembering certain things in yourself, so that the scene becomes, in a sense, a part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself as directing with the method, with that method?
I think I do, yes. I think I try to get the real thing out of actors, and I try to stop them from what we call indicating or gesturing, suggesting a scene by the way they are. In England, they do it differently. The voice is very important there, and the way they have different kinds of plays there. And I don't think that I'm any good to direct Shakespeare or George Bernard Shaw or any play that depends on the way lines are read. I think I'm only good when the play relates to my own experience.
And to the experience of the actor who's playing it.
That's correct. Right, Terry.
Now, your autobiography is really the first time you've publicly addressed why you named names during the HUAC hearings
right.
In the 1950s. And I was wondering why you were ready to talk about it now. For years when you were interviewed, people would ask you about it and you just wouldn't want to talk about it. People have written in their autobiographies how they felt about you naming names, but you've never publicly addressed it till now.
The reason I felt okay about it now was that I always hesitated to do it because I wanted to make it part of my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so that everything that happened before had some way or other, not for others, but for me, led up to it. And for example, I put in the scene where the man from Detroit came and attacked me in front of my group. I put in the scene where we were trying to do a picture in Mexico and the communists there prevented us from doing it for their reasons. I put in other references so that by the time I got to it, you felt I'd been through certain experiences that would at least motivate me, if no one else, into doing that.
Well, my understanding is that you decided to talk for two reasons. One was that you felt that when you were a member of a communist group that the actors were really exploited by the party, and also that you didn't want to give up your career, that you'd really thought about it, and you decided that writers could write while they're in prison, but directors couldn't do anything in prison, and directors couldn't do anything if they were shut out of the industry.
Something like that, but not exactly. I thought, you know, I love my work, and it means everything to me. It's my whole life, really. Except my family and my work. Those are the two things I have. And I thought, why should I give up my career for something I don't believe in? I don't believe in it. I don't. And if people who are communists are still are going to attack me and still feel that they don't want to talk about it, I also feel that then the hell with them. I also feel that any country, for example, England and France, any country has the right to investigate something like was going on in this country. And the only trouble with our committee was that two of the fellows lied to me. They told me that I was in an executive session where I'd be talking privately, and it turned out they were running with the news to Hollywood gossip columnists and everything else, so I lost my respect for them, too.
There are many people who have been in your life who've never forgiven you for naming names and have certainly never forgotten it. Did you expect this decision to stay with you throughout your life in the way that it has?
No, you have to believe me, Terry. I don't give a darn about that.
Uh-huh.
I only am concerned, really, whether I respect myself. I thought a very long time about it. I thought very hard about it, and I did I made a difficult choice. Both sides, both ways would have been difficult for me.
Ilya Kazan is my guest. I want to get to something you say at the very, very end of your book. You say that when you die, you don't want a big memorial shindig with lots of speeches. You want a big party, but no speeches, and you want everyone that you've ever known invited, including even your enemies, if they're still alive.
Yeah, that's right.
Why do you want that?
Well, because I'm an old-fashioned family-type Mediterranean man. I do like my family enormously. I have a great big family. I have five grandchildren, one more on the way. I have five children. I have stepchildren. I have all kinds of friends that I've had through the years. Not alienated, the opposite. They've become closer and closer. And I just want to say to them, thank you very much for what you've given me in the way of experience and happiness. And here, have a party. And there are all my sweaters and books and things. Help yourself.
Okay. I bet you wish you could be around to watch this party when it happens.
I would, yes. I would. I hope there's good liquor there, that's all. I hope nobody gets a hangover.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. You've been very nice.
Ilya Kazan in 1988. He died yesterday at the age of 94. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video, featuring the films of James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart, and Errol Flynn in the new Warner Legends Collection on DVD, and from Dutton Books, publisher of La Faire, A Comedy of Manners and Culture Clash by Diane Johnson, author of Le Divorce. An excerpt is available at authordianejohnson.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Lethem, the author of Motherless Brooklyn, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. He has a new novel, The Fortress of Solitude, about a friendship between two boys, one white, one black, in 1970s Brooklyn. Join us for the next Fresh Air.